In this edition of the Half-Life Show, we talk to Dr. Siddharth Mohan, a biophysicist and an expert in protein biochemistry. He is a friend of ours for many years, and we often refer to him interchangeably as Sid and Sidmo throughout the episode. He is an excellent teacher who is able to break down even the most complex topics into what he calls despicable analogies. We talk about the fundamental building blocks of life, the wonders and secrets that Mother Nature won't reveal to us, and the implications of learning those secrets on the future of humanity. We discuss drug discovery and how the entire scientific community came together as one to develop and deliver the COVID-19 vaccine to the world. Throughout the conversation, you will hear in his voice the excitement, respect, and wonder he has for science and nature. Through his lens, Subbu and I developed a deeper appreciation for the world around us, and we hope you will feel the same through this episode. We talk about his personal journey, his inspirations and influences, which got him to where he is today. Siddharth is an excellent heavy metal drummer, even though he trained as a classical pianist, and the co-founder of What's the Scene India, which showcases and promotes the live music scene in India and has a dozen editorial teams in various cities all over India. Now, on to the episode. The whole reason we got started about all these things of what you do, Sid, as, you know, biophysicist that you are, is when you visited San Diego and you came down for the American Chemical Society conference.
That's right.
When you stopped by my place, this is what we did, right? We put up a campfire in the backyard and then poured ourselves a couple of whiskeys and got started on talking about biology and physics and all that stuff. So basically, what we're trying to do is recreate that environment, right? And get you to say some of those cool things we spoke about. Because Subbu over here was not privy to that awesome conversation. So that's why we definitely have to get you on the podcast and now get you to explain those cool things you told me. And probably more.
No pressure. Yeah. And so while I aim to please, let it be known that most sequels fail. And so that is the disclaimer I'm definitely putting up front before we sort of dive into it. And the one thing I do want to say is it really helps. I think I TA'd a lot. I was a teaching assistant in graduate school for many years. And to explain a lot of concepts, I found myself clutching at straws with explaining things in an academic way, which is taking the same scientific principle and just sort of rehashing it. So I started boiling things down to terrible, absolutely despicable analogies. But for some reason, they would often work. And one of the things that I explain is this idea of this Leventhal's paradox, which I know you guys have asked me about before. And the analogy actually is not sort of unique to me. It is derived from conversations in the field of protein folding and protein science, where these chains of proteins are sort of compared to beads on a string. And so the idea of a long sort of string that has an inherently, you know, you can think of it as a two-dimensional entity. It's just a bunch of characters on a screen. Actually has a three-dimensional implication. And so that field of protein folding is kind of at the core of what I do as a scientist and what fascinated me and sort of got me into the field in the first place.
We've all heard of proteins, right? What is the importance of proteins and why is the synthesis of proteins so important to the functioning of the human body or any biological system, for example?
Especially because you have a lot of bros, right? I mean, especially, say, in office in the gym, who are smacking themselves with two or three protein shakes a day. And, you know, there's this very big, you know, there's a big call out for increasing protein, especially in Indian diets, you know, because it's not, our current diets is not good enough and so on, right? So, yeah, that's a good question. Let's start there. Okay, why do we need protein? What's it
Why
doing
do we need protein? Oh my God, that's a jacked question to take your protein analogy as far as you want to.
Protein shake.
But simply said, they are the biomolecular basis of life. It sounds like a very sort of grandstanding type of statement, but it is fundamentally true. you are alive and breathing and you're able to sit here and hear and see and smell and taste, since we're enjoying some nice beverages, because of proteins. They are the sort of biological molecules that perform and execute pretty much all of life's functions, right? They break down the sugar, they help you flex your arm. They are the fundamental biological basis of life. They mediate all life and all functions.
Awesome. So it can make an organism function better. The lack of proteins can kill, and exactly. You know, misformed proteins can affect the functioning of various functions of the body, things like that.
So, you know, for all things to be okay, all of these proteins and these little molecules have to fold and look a certain way and kind of behave in a certain way if they have to chow down on a sugar or break down fat or whatever it is, right? There's a lot of functions. And exactly, you hit upon the converse, which is that if they are not folded correctly, and folding is a very important word, we will get to that in a bit, then things can go astray. And so disease is born out of that. There's issues, health issues. And that kind of segues into, I think, what you were saying, Subbu, that, you know, why is protein necessary for health? And why is it necessary for building muscle, right? So there's, I don't obviously know exactly the mechanisms of how they are broken down and consumed. But in general, the idea is that your muscles are made of these cells that contain a particular protein called myosin. And that is really responsible for the compression of the muscle and the tissue, and that's what causes movement. And so the more of that you have, the stronger you are, the faster you are, et cetera, et cetera. And so being able to really consume protein and break it down and really metabolize it and force the body to take up that protein that you have consumed from outside means you can put on muscle, you can gain muscle mass, so to speak.
So you mentioned protein folding a couple of times, right? And I hear this a lot in our other medicine-related podcasts and stuff. And anytime someone says protein folding, this picture of like a thin sheet of paper, like paper folding, that's the image that comes to my mind. I mean, am I in the ballpark or do I have it completely wrong in my head?
Does maybe it look one extra dimension added to it. Yeah. You're in the ballpark, but it's in a different plane. I would reduce that, simplify it to beads on a string. So instead of a paper that's being crumpled, think of it as a very long chain of these beads. And I'll dive into that analogy right away, right? So there are 20 basic amino acids. They are the fundamental amino acids and the building blocks of proteins. So if you want to talk about these in terms of the analogy, there's 20 different colored beads, let's say, okay? And those beads all have unique properties as a result of their little colors. And so, you know, you can attach the beads end on end, and you can make a chain that's as long as you want and in any sequence of colors as you want, right? So if you think about that from just a mathematical standpoint, there's a huge space, there's a huge coordinate space in which the sequence of these things can exist and the shapes that you can crumple this string of beads into. It's gigantic, right? There's virtually limitless numbers of conformations, if you want to call it that. So protein folding specifically deals with this field at the molecular level. And why is that relevant, right? So it deals with it. But why is it relevant, right? It's So I said that, okay, proteins form the basis of all life. They mediate all these functions. So, you know, Pac-Man needs to be yellow and have a conical mouth to run around the track. If he was any other color, DOS would reject the game. And that's exactly the same thing with proteins. If you have a bead and it goes blue, blue, red, red, black, yellow, green, yellow, red. And if you that forms a chain that may be a crumpled little ball of yarn that looks a certain way, and that can chew down on a sugar, let's say, right? Now, if you change that last bead to a purple, suddenly the whole thing falls apart. It happens. Now the question is, why does it happen?
Can I ask you one question right before that?
Yeah. This analogy moves fast, so please, yeah.
Are there any protein sequences that are purely a straight line, or do they all have to fold? And if they have to fold, why do they actually fold?
So they have to fold. So there is no real blanket rule. Nature has evolved. So over time, proteins are as long and as folded as they need to be to do a function.
Oh,
so it's driven by need, not just by, oh, you know, I have something that's 800,000 sequence amino acids long, therefore it is not folding. Like, that's not the way we think about it. So nature has evolved to say, oh, if I need 3 amino acids to do this function, I'll bet you money that there's something out there that doesn't. Now, is there something? Probably not. You need a little more of a three-dimensional shape to do certain functions. That is, therefore, the prerequisite is that it has to be at least a few more amino acids long so that it can kind of fold and form a relatively more interesting three-dimensional structure.
Okay, that is, I think that's the best analogy I've heard of protein folding. Now, this protein folding is, in my mind, is going to switch from an image of folded or crumpled paper to Pac-Man of different colors. And a different color essentially represents what kind of sugars or what kind of molecules it can chomp on.
Absolutely. I think that's a good analogy to start off, considering, you know, you said there was a 5-year cutoff here. Don't do that. Yeah.
So now, this is very interesting, right? I mean, I have this graphic image of how proteins fold in my mind now. But do you guys actually see this in under? Is that how they actually look under a microscope? How are you guys seeing this? How do you observe proteins folded?
So there's a lot of inferential work that is done. You don't really see it. There's enough information gleaned from freezing, let's call it freezing, the folding process. And there's also ways to interrogate it. And when I say interrogate, I mean you could change those beads one by one through biotechnological means and see if the folding rate changes. And then you can sort of take snapshots. Instead of requiring a high-speed video camera to do it, there are ways to kind of take a good SLR picture of it. And then you can then put those images together in sequence and you can kind of elucidate the sequence of how these things are happening and the actual pathway. Now, that being said, that is very, very sort of cutting edge and very challenging work to do. And there are other ways to kind of understand it without really needing to sort of visualize it as a video. And nowadays with molecular dynamics simulations, known as MD simulations, you can render every single atom in three-dimensional space in a computer and put in all of the basic rules of physics and chemistry. Like, you know, if there's charged particles next to each other, then they will either attract or repel. And you can do this at scale, right? And then you can kind of visualize the entire protein as if you were at the scale of the protein. And so the more refined the models get based on the information you get from other science and other experiments, the more informative these simulations themselves become. So it's a little bit of a bootstrappish process. But the idea is that, you know, we're learning and we're obviously improving the models as we go. And but there is no all-encompassing route for protein folding, which is why we're even doing this research in the first place, which, you know, brings us into all these sort of paradoxes and questions as to, well, you know, what if I change this? What happens if I change this? I think, Vikram, you were saying earlier, why does it need to fold in this way, right? So if I change that one bead at that end or somewhere in the middle, it suddenly changed the fold and it crumpled into a different ball of yarn. So the question is, why does that even happen? Yes, we've seen that it happens. We know that it happens, but we don't really understand why. And that is the most fascinating and frustrating thing about these molecules.
So it looks like there is a law that nature is following that dictates the folding of these proteins, but it is probably the greatest kept secret of life that we are not privy to yet as human beings.
You know, that's not an understatement. I think one of the holy grail of protein science is to be able to understand this given any sequence of amino acids. Basically, if I gave you a string with any number and any sequence of these colored beads, you should be able to tell me exactly what three-dimensional structure it will form. We do not know that yet, which is kind of crazy to me at the same time, right? I mean, we have all this amazing knowledge. We know so much. We have all these orthogonal ways of sort of tapping into the system. And without knowing this per se, we can still make the most amazing medicines absolutely life-changing, you know, technology out there, just sort of treating it a little more empirically without really knowing the fundamental mechanisms. And that's because, you know, these things are reliable. There are some rules, like you alluded to, and we have some understanding of it. And sometimes it's enough to actually have these breakthroughs, whether it's vaccines or it's, you know, therapeutics for cancer or anything, like, you know, pick any medicine. There's so much that we know, and yet there's so much that we don't know. So it's a very interesting place to be as a scientist.
So initially, you mentioned that there are an infinite number of combinations given these 20 basic beads, colored beads on a string. The number of possibilities are endless. So it sounds like, to me, it's a gigantic computational issue.
Yes.
So we have today probably the greatest computing in the history of mankind. We have supercomputers, and I have come across this other project called Folding at Home, which means that you can even contribute your own personal computer and your own CPU, and it's in the show notes. So we have practically everybody's personal computer at our disposal, if you're willing to contribute to this project.
Yes.
So in spite of all this, we are not able to overcome the computational complexity that is involved in predicting protein folding?
Sadly, yes, because you cannot brute force this problem. I think that is the fundamental block. And why you can't brute force this is because the sample space is gigantic.
So, Vikram, what you're telling me is, instead of using my compute resources towards mining Bitcoin, I should rather put it towards protein folding and at least save a life.
Yes.
And eventually make an NFT out of it, whatever that means in this space.
You see,
right?
You know, Bitcoins are only 21 million, right? But so how much are you going to mine? There are only 21 million Bitcoins. But if you can solve protein folding, you have solved the secret of life. So yes, please contribute to that instead.
And Mo, you made a joke about NFTs. None of the three of us know nothing about it, but I'm sure what you said makes sense.
Because in our space with this protein folding, you know, the conversation, NFT probably stands for non-folding talk.
Oh God! I'll give you a B minus on the joke.
Oh my God, yeah, I'll take it. But let's talk about this. I know, Vicky, you mentioned, you know, we have all these computational resources. You would think that, you know, this is something that's really truly within our grasp and that we should be able to solve this problem. And the reason that we can't is because it's just too large a sample space. And so let's try and use this beads on a string analogy to kind of break it down, right? So let's talk about maybe a 5-bead string. So nothing crazy here. And let's assume that these 5 beads fold into something that looks like, you know, a little bit of a knot, a small knot. You could hold it in your wrist. Okay. It's a reasonably sized bead, about a centimeter. So you have something that crumples into maybe an inch in diameter. Now, we said that the beads have a distinct relationship with each other, you know, based on their properties, some basic biochemical properties, charge, whether they're sticky, they like water, they don't like water, etc. And so that determines the kind of relationship between the two of them. So if you take 2 beads, or the first two, let's take number 1 and number 2, you know, blue and red. If you lock the position of 1 bead, then the red bead, let's just say it can be in 1 of 3 angles relative to the blue bead. So it can be either, you know, look if you're looking down the string, then if you have the blue bead, the red bead can either be here, maybe so at 0 degrees, maybe at, you know, 120 degrees, and then maybe at, you know, 240 degrees, and then back at zero. So 1 of 3 conformations. Let's call that a conformation, right?
So any 3 angles. So let's look at it this way. So if you're looking at it, think about it something like a Mercedes symbol.
Perfect.
Right? You've got 3 places. So you're looking at it.
Yes.
You want to put the 2nd bead at any of the 3 tips of the Mercedes symbol. So these are your 3 choices.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And now you extend that to the relationship between bead number 2 and bead number 3, bead number 3 and bead number 4. 4 and 5, etc., right? So it becomes an n raised to 3 number of combinations, right? Where n is the length, or n minus 1 if you want to get into the details, because the first one is locked.
Hmm.
So let's say for a 100-bead string, there are 99 such, so it'll be 99 raised to 3. what I did was I was very generous with the number of confirmations that you can use. I said you can do 3. Okay. But there's infinite. If you look at it in three-dimensional space, there's the whole 360 degrees. So you can either sample it every degree, every half degree. It's limitless, right? But even if you lock that down, now, actually, in nature, there are some very specific angles that you can actually work the amino acids relative to each other. They're known as the phi and psi angles. So that's the sort of actual limitations of where these things can exist relative to each other. Even if you take those limitations into account, and if you could sample every single combination at a picosecond scale, okay, every picosecond you can sample one conformation of one bead relative to each other. When you scale it to the length of a protein, given the phi and psi angles, it will take longer than the age of the universe to compute the entire chain's entire sequence, the entire set of folds. Which is impossible. Okay, so but the paradox that Cyrus Leventhal talked about, I think in 1968, 1969, was that this is a thought experiment, right? There aren't really beads on a string. They are amino acids. They exist in nature. The thought experiment was, it would take a really, 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 really long amount of time to compute all of those folds and map them out and have a piece of paper in which you can draw them out and say, oh, okay, look, the one that is in nature is number 9,451, billionth, whatever. Okay, but in nature, this happens on the millisecond timescale, right? So, because proteins are translated, they are read off, the ribosome, they're generated off the ribosome in the cell, and they kind of fold kind of immediately, and boom, they're ready. It's like animals in the wild, the giraffe gives birth and that the baby giraffe can walk in no time. It's basically that at the molecular level. That's a terrible analogy, we're sticking with it. So, the paradox is that it happens in nature at the millisecond time scale, and these proteins are viable and they work. But if you were to brute force this algorithm computationally, you wouldn't be able to solve the problem. So what gives? What are those rules that we don't know? We're occluded. We don't really understand fully what's going on. But I obviously have to, there is a disclaimer there in that we are shining more and more light on that every single day. There's a lot of research, and I do not want to discredit anyone's effort in doing it. It's a noble problem to solve. But like you alluded to earlier, Vikram, it is the answer to life. If we can figure this out, then I can give you any amino acid sequence, and you would be able to tell its exact fold.
And that's what nature does in the scale of milliseconds to a second, roughly.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Okay, so now all of this stuff, right, all these experiments that you're running. So what does an experiment look like? So I'm guessing that a large number of experiments that you run are trying to take X number of amino acids, put it in a chain, and study how it folds. Is that what you're... what are your experiments like?
Yeah, that's one. That's, I think, protein folding labs specifically interrogate and try and test different sequences to see if there's any impact on the function of the protein and, how long does it take to fold. And some of my research actually had to do with trying to understand the interactions between beads in the sequence and through sort of relying on what evolution has already done. So another sort of twist to the story is that there are a lot of proteins, and proteins exist that they can be called the same name, it doesn't really matter, that can execute the same function in different organisms, in humans, in maybe an albatross that flies really high in the sky, or in a little bacterium that sits at the bottom of a deep sea vent. And these proteins can do exactly the same function in these different evolutionary niches. Right, so you'd expect their structure to be identical, maybe, or close, very, very, very similar. And since their structure is derived from or sort of dependent on the sequence, because we've already established that the exact sequence determines the fold, right? That the sequences would also be the same. Now, that's the wrench that nature has thrown at us. these sequences need not be the same, and they aren't. We've seen in nature that there's families of proteins that can execute the exact same function, break down the same sugar, and do the same thing in a metabolic pathway, for example, but can have slightly varying structures, slightly, and vastly different sequences. So now that opens up another can of worms. It's like, okay, wait, what? I thought a sequence determines a fold, and I thought it's going to be only that. But nature has allowed for some wiggle room. Right. I mean, very literally, there is wiggle room wherein very similar sequences, and now you can start quantifying what this word similar means. You can start thinking about these similar sequences and the impact on changing those specific positions on the activity of the protein, on its function.
So are you saying that if we go back to your previous example of a protein with five beads, right? For five beads of specific colors?
Sure.
So that could fold in different ways and could behave differently in a bacterium versus an albatross versus a human?
No, it could fold in slightly different ways based on maybe you change the fifth bead, okay. But it'll do the same function.
Ah, okay.
So that's another twist, right? You'd expect the same sequence, to do one function, but there is some amount of promiscuity, so to speak.
So the sequences are different, but that means the physical structure is also different, but they perform the same function.
They'll be very, very similar. There may be minor changes in parts of the protein that may not be critical to the execution of the function, but exist there for a reason, maybe because it helps the albatross metabolize faster. Or, okay, maybe I think the easier analogy is, suppose this same protein exists in humans and in a bacterium that lives at the bottom of a deep sea vent, right? Deep sea vent, extremely high pressure, extremely hot. And proteins are biological molecules. They are inherently fragile. And what that means is that they are as stable as they need to be in the niches that they exist, right? You don't need a protein in your body to be able to tolerate boiling temperatures. That is just a waste of evolutionary resources to have to find that sequence, right? That, oh, you know, you're rock solid, great. No use for you.
Yeah.
So over time, but what has happened is those sequences have changed enough that they can do this exact metabolic function, but they can tolerate that extreme heat and pressure because it is critical to the organism's survival. And so that is where those slight differences come in the sense that maybe the catalytic activity is the same, but some structural component is different. And that is where you'll also begin to see the delineation of, or mild delineation of, structurally important positions in the protein and catalytically important positions in the protein. So it's not all amino acids are equal, but some are more equal than others. So that's a salute to George Orwell right there.
So it's what is important from this example you just gave is that even slight changes in protein, in the protein or the sequence of amino acids can create vastly different impacts on an organism, like the deep sea vent organism versus us, chilling out by the beach kind of an organism, right? But doing Absolutely. The same function, which means conversely speaking, suppose we figure out nature's secret of how to predict the fold of a given amino acid sequence, which means that we can now engineer life to the way we want it.
That is exactly right. And before we even go to engineering life, which is, if you look at a single-celled organism, right, that has life, that has a complex set of biological functions being executed in real time. It's really, really complicated, even though it looks pretty boring under a microscope. Now, I don't want to, sling mud at any biologist, but before we even get to engineering life, I want to take what you just said and even dial it down to the level of, let's engineer the proteins, right? So protein engineering as a field itself is vast. There's so much that can be done to just make biologically active molecules and engineer them for a specific purpose. Now, I don't know if you remember, but back home in India, we had a new set of these dishwashing liquids and soaps being marketed. And they were like, oh, it has enzymes for catalysis to break down, dirt and grime and stuff. You remember that? It was like such a
fascinating
thing.
And they show these gooey little things running all over.
Now, unfortunate as the scaling is, in terms of the size, you can't see these things. They're microscopic. The reality is that we were making these proteins and these enzymes, and they are exactly what we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. They're three-dimensional molecules that are very precise and can do very precise functions very quickly. I will add that I was a little underwhelmed by those advertisements, because by that time I had fully understood what enzymes were, and I was like face palming every time those ads would play.
Yeah.
So like, first of all, that is as big as like, you know, a golf ball compared to like the earth, and you're showing the earth in the ad. I mean, these enzymes are molecules, they're not little bugs, you know.
Yeah. So the next time one of your uncles asks you, son, what do you do for a living? Tell him, hey, your shirts are cleaner because of me. Your dishes are cleaner because of me.
You know, I had, I was talking to, there was one gentleman who was asked this question. I don't remember who he was, but it was a while ago in my field. And someone had asked him, oh, what do you do for a living? And he was in, you know, like therapeutics, biopharmaceuticals. And he gave a somewhat dark answer. He said, I help you die better.
Oh my God.
Which, while precise, can be a little disconcerting. And unfortunately, that hasn't left my mind. I'm tempted to often say that. So I have to check myself when someone asks me, what do you do for a living? Oh, I make medicines that extend your life, that help you die better. No. Let's not say that.
By the way, now that you mentioned this, you know, how to die better because we have better drugs, does all this, like, you know, protein folding and the discovery of how these things behave actually help us make better drugs?
Absolutely. It's undeniable. I mean, a lot of the interactions between molecules, whether it's an enzyme eating its substrate or it's an antibody binding an antigen, which is the, you know, fundamental basis for a lot of treatments of lots of cancers and immunological disorders and whatnot. All of that is informed by that very, very specific site or sites, or those specific sites of interactions between molecules. So they're called, you know, binding sites or interacting sites or whatever. Now, and remember that all of these surfaces and points of contact between molecules, maybe you're trying to block the function of a cell that's gone haywire, and right, that can be implicated in cancer, right? So you want to be able to specifically bind one type of cell, and you want to do this quickly, you want to do this reliably. You don't want any promiscuous binding and off-target binding, because then the drug is doing random crazy things. And you want to be able to also clear the drug from the system. So I'm capturing very broadly and very, I've simplified a lot of the prerequisites for what a molecule like that should be like, what its behavior in the bloodstream should be like. You know, is it something that you have to ingest? Well, if you're going to ingest the molecule, it has to survive the, you know, the digestive tract, it has to survive the digestion process, it has to enter your bloodstream, it has to find the cancerous tissue, it has to bind the cancerous cell, it has to maybe trigger another set of events to maybe trigger your immune system to recognize that troublesome cell, and then, you know, then your immune system can attack the cancerous cell, and then you're sort of treated of that cancer. And so, you know, with as far as these mechanisms are concerned, I really like talking about them from a warring government and agents and spies kind of view. Your immune system is basically a highly coordinated network of agents and warriors and informants and battle structures and databases and, you know, stuff like that. And viruses and cancers are infiltrators. That's basically the analogy, right? That's how they override, that's how they cheat, and that's how they can stay hidden. You know, cancerous tissue basically evades the immune system. So a lot of new age cancer therapies and treatments are immunocentric, which is, we will not directly target the cancer. We will act as flags. We will act as guides. You know, so you deliver a molecule that can basically, specifically, it doesn't kill the cancer cell, but it flags the cancer cell. So its only job is to alert your immune system.
Mm.
So it is now, you can think of it as a target, like you're painting. It's like, you know, you're able to get in there, you're painting the target, and you're leaving.
Nice.
So that way you're leveraging the body's own system. So it's, you know, quote unquote, a little healthier, a little safer, a little less toxic. At least those are the plans, and that's the vision of drugs like this.
So these drugs go in and put like bullseye targets on the problem cells, for the immune system to then come and take over. So it's not actually taking care of the problem cell on its own. It's just putting a target on it and, you know, getting out of there so that the body's immune system can do it on its own.
Yes.
So is protein folding just one of the mechanisms of drug development? Are there like other bases for drug development that are popular?
Protein folding in general is the collective set of phenomena that determine the three-dimensional structure from the sequence information. Understanding protein folding has implications on drug development, but it's not like that is the pathway to drug development. Drug development can happen and does happen irrespective of that, right? So at the end of the day, like I said, there are interacting sites and we can interrogate and change those beads so that those proteins can, you know, either look, you know, like triangles attacking a sphere or squares attacking a sphere, or you have a concave surface that attacks a sphere, which is ideally, you know, the best match. We can do that without really having to worry too much about protein folding. But that isn't to say that it's, you know, fully exclusive. Of course, understanding protein folding means that maybe you can engineer a better concave structure, right, to attack a ball like cancer cell, for example. I'm really pushing that analogy very, very far. It's about to break, but we can take a step back and, you know.
Yeah, let's see if we can take a step back and see, you know, how we can use a simple example, right? We all get these like mild fevers or whatever, and we go to a local grocery store or drug store and get a little Tylenol, Advil, Crocin. You know, there are so many brand names, but I guess they're all paracetamols, ultimately. But how do you even make something like that? Let's say, you know, I ask you, hey, can you make me a drug that reduces the body temperature? So how would you even start on a problem like that?
Well, other than asking for $1 billion, I would require what is called as a compound library. So, you know, back when we didn't really know that much about biologics-based drugs and protein folding was not very, very well developed as a field, and we didn't really have a very good grasp on biotechnological tools. Medicinal sort of chemistry was the way to go. And so you had compound libraries, you know, organic compounds, and organic chemists would make organic compounds that spanned a variety of different shapes and sizes, and they had a huge plethora of properties. And you could make these way, way faster than you can make a biologic. You can make them very rapidly. You can make a very, very large variety of these things. And you would basically have, you know, pharmaceutical companies that owned these compound libraries. And then you would really rely on thorough screening. So the science is not in the generation of the molecules alone. It truly is in the ability to screen for a valid function, being able to reduce, like you said, the fever or you know, help attenuate some trauma, right? For some reason, yeah, whether it's to increase the rate at which a blood clots when you have a cut, or you so all of that is born out of a marriage between a chemistry from an organic chemistry standpoint and a knowledge of biology as it continues to progress over time. And so being able to see which of those interacting partners can interact can lead to the development of pharmaceutical compounds.
So is that what you mean by screening? Like, as in, you got all these compounds in a library and you have some effects they generate, and it's like a match one to the other? Is that what screening is?
That screening is basically that the actual experimentation that I know, Subbu, you were sort of asking earlier, what do we do? I think that is the core of the experimentation. It's, you know, one is making the molecules and having a vast array and tools, but then only one wrench really can tighten the bolt, right? And so you have to try the different tools to see what fits and what can do the function the best. Okay. What doesn't hurt your hand? What is easy to tune to different varieties of bolts? What has a reliable metal, let's say, or what has an aesthetically nice, pleasing shape? You know, pick your analogy. But the idea is that screening is where the challenge of finding the right molecule or the best molecule within the list that you have. And so a lot of the data analysis and promoting those molecules through a pipeline, so to speak, is where that comes from.
Nice.
The idea of screening for the best function and finding the best molecule for that purpose.
So you have a bunch of scientists whose main job is to show up at work every day and create these molecules. And I guess by trial and error, figure out how those molecules behave. And if it is something novel, then add it to the database.
That is a good oversimplification. Yes. A bunch of us just turn up, we high-five each other, we run one experiment, we find the best molecule, and $1 billion later, we have the drug.
So you just do random shit till it works?
Exactly, right? I mean, but that's where a lot of empirical work actually comes in, right? So treating things like an engineer actually really helps, which is where I sometimes find myself. Like, it's great to have that ability to tap into the fundamental science and see what you're doing. But at the same time, you want to be able to zoom out, look at it from a slightly broader perspective, treat your engine or experiment as a black box. And just time is money. So at the end of the day, you want to find something quickly rather than later. So, but to your answer, to your question, Subbu, the experimentation and the database and the data analysis, yeah, that is promoted down the line, and you have to do a lot of experiments to, first of all, repeat those effects. Right? It could be some random effect. Maybe the sun was shining through the window that day, and so, you know, that heated it a little extra and something worked. So that kind of scientific, what is the right word?
Repeatability.
Repeatability and testing the veracity of it is really critical, I think. Now, that being said, before you even, you know, it doesn't just go to the market as a drug. It doesn't turn up on the shelf.
Yes.
That's where it needs massive approvals. There's a huge approval process. The FDA is involved. Drug goes through trials. It has to really be effective. It has to really not kill the patient. I mean, that's probably side effect number one. And
oopsies.
But it's especially funny when you see drugs, you know, unfortunately, that are advertised as, okay, I think Robin Williams had joked about it on his stand-up show that he was looking into a drug or to take a drug. I don't know what it was for, and I could be completely wrong here. He joked about, side effects might cause anal leakage. The problem he had with that was that it was not a side effect. Like, that is an effect. That's what he said.
Oh, God, that is incredible. Okay, so two questions. Now, we're talking about trial and error, empirically studying molecules and things like that, right? Now, we know that, some popular drugs like penicillin were discovered through accident, right? Now, now, the question is that, what percentage of these drugs, how much of it is accident and how much of it is, intentionally drilling down and meticulous experimentation? Or, you know where I'm going with this?
Almost.
How much is it fluke is what I'm asking.
Very, very, very little. I think the kind of breakthrough. So why penicillin is even there in the public consciousness is that because it was revolutionary, right? We had no idea that there was such a biological mechanism, right? That there was a set of compounds generated by a fungus that can do this. So it's kind of crazy that. Well, I think it was also a little bit of an eventuality. Like, I believe that a lot of discoveries in science and as we progress as a species in the great universe that we live in are eventual discoveries. So those are the sort of maybe known. I think penicillin to us at that time was definitely an unknown. So that's why it was a game changer. And the fact that we could then mimic the biological processes in a chemistry lab to make that class of molecules and then change a few of the bells and whistles on those molecules, and I'm definitely oversimplifying here, to attack different kinds of infections and fight against different kinds of infections, that was a game-changing thing. It was unbelievable and unheard of, right? There was no idea that we could do this. And then we did it. And then, obviously, the effect on, like the war happened. And so, with injuries and infections, it was definitely, it had a truly global impact. And we see that across the board over time, whether it's the development of medicines or the development of technology, right? So, penicillin is one example. But the polymerase chain reaction, PCR, is another example. And some of the vaccine is ridiculous. It's like it's so present right now, but when you fast forward to 50 years later, it's going to be looked at as one of the major feats of humankind. I would say it rivals the landing on the moon.
You mean the generation of the COVID vaccine in the time span that we did it as a human species to combat something totally unknown to our kind?
Yep.
And, you know, yep, have a mass produce a vaccine that works to a large percentage on almost the entire population with almost minimal side effect, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Has never been done before. And if it has been done before, if I've gotten my facts wrong, not at this scale. So definitely this, while the scale of this enterprise is incredible, the fact is that the mRNA vaccine platform as a sort of technology is revolutionary. We always knew that we could do this. I think there were a lot of difficulties and challenges faced by companies who dabbled in mRNA technology. And, you know, thankfully, companies like Moderna had a lot of their platforms in place. So, and this is where the sort of empirical testing and screening really is important. Like, you can have the best knowledge, but if you, and you can make the what you think is the best molecule, but there's no way to really truly test its efficaciousness and its effectiveness if you don't have the right screening. And to be able to do that for millions and millions and millions of molecules very, very rapidly. So I think a company like Moderna, this may be like a plug for them, an unintentional plug for them, but that's okay. They are, I think, at that, you know, they're on the pinnacle right now. But the fact that they could do that is a big deal. It's a big deal just for the human species, not just for the company.
From a biology point of view, why do you view this discovery and, you know, implementation of the COVID vaccine and it being mRNA based as something so significant to humankind? I kind of stated it from layman's perspective, but from a biology point of view, why do you think it's significant?
It is significant because we'll need a little bit of a primer before we can apply this layer of paint. So here go all aboard the analogy train once again.
Let's go. Okay.
So the basic sort of paradigm of molecular biology is DNA is transcribed to form RNA, and RNA is translated to form protein. So we have all lived through the excitement of the Human Genome Project, right? We all know that was in the public consciousness for a decade. I think billions of dollars were spent on kind of decoding the human genome. So why was this so important, right? And this is like really a far step back, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit. But the idea that we will have an end-to-end knowledge of the alphabet that makes up a human life was undeniably attractive. It was absolutely essential that we understand this as a species, because all proteins come from DNA, right? It's that sequence that we spoke about of proteins is a photocopy. And here's where the analogy comes in, right? So let's just talk about this. DNA is the blueprint of all life, okay? And I'm, again, oversimplifying. But if you think about this as the Coca-Cola recipe, right? The recipe for Coca-Cola is supposedly stored in a locker somewhere, and there's just that one copy. You know, if you take that same analogy, DNA is that one copy. It's in the cell. But you have to make Coca-Cola. So someone has to have access to that copy, that blueprint. They have to have access to a highly regulated Xerox machine to generate the photocopies that only one FedEx company can ship to the different printing centers at different Coca-Cola factories so that you can make Coca-Cola, right? So in this analogy, the photocopies, the RNA, the messenger RNA, okay? And the factories are the ribosomes that take the transcript, the mRNA transcript, which is the black and white photocopy. The blueprint stays in the locker, okay? And then takes all the ingredients, the different beads on the string, and is able to make this Coke bottle, which in this case analogy is the protein. So to be able to read that blueprint in its entirety would mean to know everything about cola, if you want to take that analogy to the limit, right? So that was the Human Genome Project. Now, in biotechnology, we can sort of interrogate all these amino acids and, you know, change these different protein sequences and study protein folding, because we can change the DNA. We can shove this DNA into a microorganism, and the microorganism can act as the photocopier and the factory at the same time. Great. So we can make different kinds of cola. Let's say the cherry cola and the orange cola, based on how what we tell, how we are hacking into the transcript in the locker, in the DNA in the locker. Okay, so is that analogy okay with us so far?
Nice.
So far, so good.
Right.
So far, so good.
So yeah. far, so good. Okay, so this is a bit of a story. The only problem is those mRNA copies, right? They're like the glasses that Tom Cruise wears in Mission Impossible. They self-destruct in 5 seconds after the message is read. Which is to say that this class of molecules is inherently unstable. And that has to do with the fundamental sort of molecular structure. There's, you know, there's an extra oxygen somewhere. And I'm not going to get into those details. But
so it's nature's, layer of, security. Security. Because you don't want these messengers to hang around with copies of important information. So once you deliver the stuff you have to, eradicate yourself, right?
Exactly. It's a very efficient. And also, more than the security, it's scalability, okay? One factory needs maybe one copy, okay? And then you can have 10,000 factories. And so you can... And the moment the factory uses the copy, it breaks down, right? It's eradicated. But if I kept sending a stream of copies to the factory, I can really make this a highly scalable system. And that's exactly what happens in the cell. You essentially have the one main blueprint kept in the nucleus of the cell for eukaryotic organisms that have a nucleus. And that DNA is transcribed. And so there's, again, regulated Xerox machines that forms the mRNA. And the mRNA then gets translated in a ribosome where the amino acids are kind of put together based on the mRNA sequence. So literally, the DNA really informs what the protein sequence is going to be. That's the basic paradigm. Now, the problem is that you think, well, why do we have to keep messing around with the DNA? Why can't we just change the mRNA and hack the system and then, we'd be set, right? Well, that's because the mRNA is unstable. So that's one of the main reasons. So to be able to go, and vaccines in general, when we deliver vaccines and older sort of vaccines and that sort of typical vaccine, if you think about it, is a protein or a killed virus, right? An attenuated virus, like the flu vaccine that you normally get every year. And these vaccines basically, you can think of them as ghosts that you introduce into the cell or into the human body. And when you introduce these ghosts or the vaccines into the human body, your immune system, remember, it's that informant network and that's that spy network. They see, they're like, this thing looks suspicious. Maybe I should call Home Guard and tell them to, prepare some troops and keep them ready. And that's exactly what it is. You're training the body to recognize it. So when or if you are unfortunate enough to get infected by a virus that the ghost was derived from, then guess what? Your immune system can go to red alert immediately before that virus and that infiltrator really infiltrates your system and does its job, which is to make you unhealthy. So that's we segued sort of very organically into what a vaccine is.
But that's a regular vaccine. Those are the kind of vaccines
but that's
that
a regular vaccine.
Okay.
Exactly. So there, you think of them as viruses that are attenuated. They look exactly like the real virus, except that they have no properties. They're just a shell of its former existence. Okay. Now, how we make that, I'm not going to go into that. Mm-hmm. But the idea with the mRNA vaccine is, remember that these viruses are proteins themselves. They have a protein coat. It's a shell of proteins, right? So let's not forget the basics here. Those proteins were derived from mRNA, which came from DNA. So ideally, you might want to be able to introduce DNA, and then your body doesn't discriminate. It says, yeah, it's DNA. I guess we'll send it to the photocopiers. We make some mRNA. They'll make some cola. Whatever. That's what you think the body will do. The body's not that naive, right? The body's also a little regulated. It's like, this looks suspiciously different. I don't trust this document. Maybe the spies are trying to outspy us and it can get really messy. So unfortunately, this analogy is being pushed to its limit. But hey, that's what we do. So the idea with mRNA vaccines was, let's introduce the mRNA, circumvent that security in the main locker. Let's just go straight to the Xerox machines. That's kind of what we're trying to do here. Okay. So you're giving the body enough information it's useful. You're not really, you know, trying to destroy the body through the vaccine. Like, that defeats the purpose. So you're trying to give the body, it's, think of it as a benevolent third party.
Okay.
A benevolent third party has infiltrated both sides of the war and has said, I favor one side. So I'm going to give the body the team on the left, which is, you know, the humans that want to survive. They seem like good people. Okay. Some information that might benefit them. And so suddenly the body's like, whoa, there's this photocopy out here. It's like, oh my God, it's sugar-free cola. I guess we can make this. It's friendlier than regular cola.
So I guess what we're doing is we're telling the messenger RNA, don't go to the nucleus of the cell where you normally get your instructions. Why don't you use this instead to make some photocopies?
Yeah, you're telling the ribosome. Yeah. The mRNA is the photocopy. So you're coming in with the fresh photocopy saying, hey, guess what?
Like, oh, okay. So you...
Kind of. I mean, there's a little more that goes on. There's a little bit of a back and forth.
This is like that, you know, in your exam in your high school, you have a little chit with the answers, right? A little help on the side. So this looks like that.
The things I've had to resort to. Huh? I'm kidding.
So we basically gave a cheat sheet or one of those chits to our body, and that's essentially what the COVID vaccine is. Saying, here you
that's
go.
That's what any vaccine is. Yeah, it's just that. Oh, actually, let's take a different analogy. So the teachers have figured out that the students are passing chits. Okay.
Okay.
So you start writing them in Morse code. Now they can't read it. Everyone in class gets it, but the teachers can't. So. Yeah.
So that's how you fool the body into accepting this new set of instructions and to trick the factories into making more proteins based on these instructions you just gave.
And what is the protein that the body is going to make? It's going to make the COVID spike protein. So then you're making the ghost. You're not just delivering the ghost to the body. You gave the body the blueprint to make the ghost, which is like some next level operation.
Oh my God, dude. I haven't. Seriously, this is such an enlightening episode.
So this is why it is like a feat. This is never been done to this level of scale. Where
before.
You tell the body to make the ghost instead of giving it the ghost, which is what we've done for decades, right? Giving the ghost. Now you make it yourself.
Yeah, And speaking to the scale of the operation, you know, people had concerns about, oh, it happened so quickly, emergency use authorization, this, that. So without me getting into the sort of geopolitical politics. Landscape of this whole thing, I think the idea here, what organizations did, and kudos to everyone who worked on all of these teams, literally from the truck drivers to the scientists, like, it doesn't matter. Every single person here knew that there was a worldwide crisis that needed to be solved and stepped up to the plate. So first of all, it's human spirit aside from the science. Like, that to me is unbelievable, that there's a group or there's groups of people out there that just got it and did something about it. So that to me is just like chilling. Like right now I'm getting chills just thinking about it. And the second thing is, a lot of these processes typically in science and in pharmaceutical development are contiguous, right? So they're abutted end to end, and they can be, and that is why, you know, it takes time, because, you know, there are checkpoints and milestones that need to be hit, and there's a lot of money and effort that goes into these things. So you obviously want to minimize the risk as the process progresses. In fact, the closer you are to making a drug, the costlier the risk of failure, right? If you think about it just from an economics perspective. Yeah. But in this particular case, I know that, I mean, there's a lot of articles in the New York Times, had a few articles where, you know, suppose there were three or four lead vaccines or drugs that, you know, had maybe very competing data, very similar data, but we didn't really know maybe the effect on the body yet. I'm just giving one example as a potential route for elimination of one of them. So you have four leads, but you can only make one, right? You only can make one at scale and share that information with the world and deploy those resources to make it. You can't have a variety of the same drug. It just doesn't make sense to do that, because then you have heterogeneous effects. You know, maybe someone takes one and the other. Like, it can be crazy. It can be an absolute storm that you do not want to weather. So, but in the spirit of reducing the timelines, the manufacturing side, for example, would make all four at scale ready to deploy. And then when the one was promoted, they would kill off the three.
Oh my God.
So we willingly took on having to waste resources, precious resources, because we needed to save time. So the groups of people who made those decisions, I mean, I salute them. It's incredible that we had that forethought. And it's so unfortunate that we had to waste some money and time and resources. But we needed the vaccine yesterday.
See, that is
especially in the beginning, especially the beginning of the whole COVID pandemic, right? In the first month, I remember, I mean, we all didn't know what we were up against as a species.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, the roads were deserted. And like in the first few days, a lot of people, including me, we stocked up on groceries and, you know, stocked up our pantries. But 3 weeks later or a month later, we still were in the same spot. We didn't know what we were up against because the death toll was rising and hospitals were inundated. And then I had to restock my groceries. So I go to this local big box store, and it was, you know, a scene from one of those movies like Contagion, where they allow, it's a huge big box store and they're allowing only 10 people to enter at a time. And it's, and everyone's like wearing these yellow suits and masks and shields. And I went out to get some a fresh stock of groceries, and I'm like, man, I don't know if I might just catch this bug and come back, but there's no food at home. What a terrible time that was.
Yeah, but
oh my God. You know, actually, it's very interesting that you mentioned Contagion. Contagion was, I think, somewhat more scientifically rooted than most other sort of sci-fi apocalyptic movies with viruses. It's kind of crazy. I mean, and the reality of the human condition sort of mixed into that, you know, with whether it's bureaucracy or a power struggle. I mean, those are real things. And so those are challenges, I think, that I'm sure people in like all of the companies that made these drugs faced. It's just, what do? You can't, we don't live in an ideal world. And in spite of that, we succeeded. So to me, this is a human feat, like I said, that rivals the moon landing, I feel.
That's a good explanation. I think really cleared that up in my mind, at least, as to why this is so amazing. This is,
yeah. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I have a newfound respect for this type of a vaccine. I didn't know, after all those countless podcasts and other stuff that and news articles I've read, I didn't have this kind of an understanding as you explained. So, thank you for that. So now Vikram and I are both electrical engineers, right? I mean, we are hardware engineers. So from from one question, that one thing I was curious about is, from a medical electronics standpoint, you spoke about all these developments, right? And all these experiments that you run, all this stuff that happens day to day in your labs. Is most of the stuff, most of your equipment that you use, is it still test tubes and pipettes and centrifuges, or can you talk about some groundbreaking electronic equipment that you use and things like that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. So to answer the first part of the question, no, I think that is definitely a vestige of your time at esteemed university where we did our undergrad.
Man, every time
and schools.
And every time I use that, the thing, I mean, I was hoping the answer is no, because every time we had to titrate and, you know, find these things, and every time I used the pipette, I drank half the solution.
Oh my God, this mouth pipetting thing. You know, when I oh my God, it's so crazy that you say this, because when I've talked to my peers or even juniors and even students here, that I had to mouth pipette, and you know, we really understood how differences in viscosity of the liquid that you were pipetting affected your mouth, because if it was too thin and you thought it was like a ghee like thing, then you're tasting like, I can veritably say I know exactly what potassium dichromate tastes like.
Dude, remember, sorry, you have to that actually forms a sentence in your life. I mean, I'm serious.
And 20 years later, I remember what industrial wastewater tastes like.
Oh my God, this gets worse. What?
That's a complex mixture. I had a monophasic one entity kind of thing, and that was bad enough. I felt like my teeth were going to fall off. Goodness. For you, I'm glad that you're here. Industrial waste is probably like, you know, I'm grateful, but also kind of sad that you're not like a teenage mutant ninja turtle sitting
exactly.
in front of me. Right
I'll now, take so. Potassium dichromate any day over Subbu stuff.
I think so too. I'm with you on that. So that's the first part of the question. No, we don't use that kind of glassware and stuff, but not on a regular basis. Yes, to handle a few mixtures and compounds here and there, we occasionally use plastics and pipettes that are, you know, mechanical, and they have variable volume adjustments, and you know they can be multi-channel. So because you can do work in a matrix format in plates right now, so that allows you to increase throughput. And that word is particularly sort of close to my heart because I work in a high throughput lab. I do a lot of screening work, and we look at multiple proteins and biologics at once instead of one at a time. And so with in terms of experiments and hardware, I can give you an example of one device. So there's I don't know the physics of this. So a lot of the devices and experimentation and experiments and instruments are based on the fact that the molecules we work with are not viewable under an ordinary microscope, right? So a biologist in a pure biology lab could see a worm and a cell with a very basic optical microscope. We can't really do that with what we have and what we work with. So you need more advanced technology. And it's not just, we need an electron microscope. But there are properties displayed by these molecules that you can sort of track through light scattering, through ultraviolet absorbance, through fluorescence, through, you know, just there's all these kinds of properties that really are derived from the fundamental makeup of these molecules. And so to that effect, you know, I can give an example. We use something called a multi-angle light scattering device. Great. Sounds amazing. What the hell does it do? So it turns out that physicists figured out that you take any object that is, you know, maybe a certain size scale, and if you have light being shone on it, the pattern or the way the light scatters as it hits the object is indicative of the size of the molecule. Great. Fantastic. So and it's also dependent on the concentration of that molecule in the solution. So you have sort of a three-variable system, vaguely speaking, right? You have the scattering effect dependent on the size of the molecule and the concentration. So now if you knew the concentration of your molecule from some other means, this can open a Pandora's box, clearly. Mm-hmm. You can now tell what the average size is. And I can use that information to tell me if there's an aggregation of the molecule in question to form larger superstructures. Like suppose they're all very sticky and they do not like being suspended in solution alone, for example. Then, you know, you'd expect the light scattering signal to correspond to its molecular weight. Oh, it's supposed to be 150 grams, 1,000 grams per mole or Daltons. But it's behaving like it's something that's 600. 600 is a multiple of 150, which means probably they're sitting in groups of four.
Wow.
So you have to establish a lot of standards and controls to really make sense of this data. But, you know, we've been able to bootstrap over the course of history to kind of make sense of what are the fundamental behaviors and sets of behaviors. And then you can kind of glean from that what your molecule looks like or how that behaves. So that's one example.
Nice. You briefly mentioned what PCR is, right? We spoke about the COVID vaccine and how that was discovered and what exactly that does. But then I've been to a PCR test site like a dozen times in the last year. So when I go to one of these sites and I get my nose swabbed or throat swabbed or whatever it is, what exactly is going on there? What do they swab and what are they looking for to see if I have COVID?
Ooh.
And I guess what does PCR in this context mean? We all use the acronym now freely. Polymerase chain reaction is a, in my limited understanding, is a significant cornerstone of scientific development. So I guess you can help us understand why that is so and how it has helped us in this COVID journey.
Yep. If I have my historical facts right, and I should as a scientist in the field with that has used and uses PCR every day, it was a Nobel Prize winning discovery by Carrie Mullis. And it really, I think, snowball, set the ball rolling, or snowballed the biotech field into what it is today. It was a fundamental sort of control over DNA sequences. You could alter and mess with DNA and change the sequence of DNA, which therefore means you can change the sequence of proteins, as we now know, to your benefit, to whether it is to explore a function or to make a drug or to test something, right? So the idea of taking some known DNA, changing it, shoving that into an organism in like Escherichia coli bacteria, and then having those E. coli bacteria pump out that protein at a relevant concentration in relevant amounts for you to do some biophysical tests meant that we could start doing protein engineering work. Really, that's just the long story short in terms of what PCR is. And why is it called polymerase chain reaction? And every time I say the full-fledged sort of the expansion of PCR, I remember this rather terrible movie with Keanu Reeves and Morgan Freeman called Chain Reaction. I don't know if you guys have seen it. But it had something to do with these fusion reactors and the runaway chain reaction. And, you know, obviously everything goes to shit. Thankfully, that's the inverse event with PCR. Now, that being said, it is a nuanced experiment and work that you can do in the lab. And it's a highly tunable sort of experiment. But what it means is you can make vast amounts of quantity. It's a chain reaction because there is multiplicity involved. So if you think of DNA as a double helix that you know we are very familiar with, what you don't see in those images and in those beautiful video renderings is that actually DNA is a set of inverted strands, right? And there's a directionality to a strand. So it's not a real ladder. It's not a parallel ladder. It's an anti-parallel ladder. That has implications on how sort of some of the molecular mechanisms happen, and they go left to right. If you're looking at a frame of reference, if you lock your frame of reference, then you know some mechanisms happen left to right on one chain, and then some mechanisms happen right to left on the other chain. That's just for general knowledge. The idea of polymerase chain reaction, I think, came about from the stories that Kenny Mullis thought about it on the way. He was away for a vacation with his wife, and he conceived the idea in his head and then left the vacation spot straight to the lab. So I don't know what happened with the marriage, but he definitely got the Nobel for that. So, you know, balance, I guess. But he sort of conceived the multiplicity. He sort of thought of it as a thought experiment, and then they had some of those sort of, I think, molecules in place. They just didn't put those building blocks together, so to speak. And so the idea is that you can rip apart the DNA strand. So when you're doing that, you're exposing, let's say, the print heads of a printer. Okay, so now you can shove paper in on this side and get a photocopy, shove paper in on this side and get a photocopy. But by doing that with a molecule that essentially acts as a photocopier, you have a sort of an exponential rise, right? So one becomes two molecules because you have the strands separated, then you make a matching strand on one, right? So if you have a photocopy of the one strand, and then the other strand will now resemble this photocopy, right? Or rather, the other strand is exactly the same as the photocopy on the other strand.
Okay, yeah.
Or not the photocopy, but it's called a complement. So it's called a complementary sequence. So the two strands already complement each other. You rip them out, then you make a complementary strand on the one that you ripped up on the left and the one that you ripped up on the right. So now one became two. Guess what happens? Two becomes four. Four becomes eight. Right, and then so that becomes really multiplicative, and I'm clearly demonstrating my lack of geometrical progressions, but the idea is that this becomes an exponential increase in the amount of DNA that you have in place. Okay, nice. This is for doing blank photocopies. I gave you the extremely naive sort of zero level PCR reaction. Right, and you can do this by regulating the heat. And the way it works is, so DNA is denatured to expose the anti-parallel strands, and then you have what is called as annealing of the primers. So the photocopying machine is called a polymerase, hence the name polymerase chain reaction. The polymerase is just an engine. It photocopies. It can read the DNA base here, and it can put in the complementary base on the other side. Yeah. So it's the photocopier machine.
So DNA is basically taking the two strands and breaking, denaturing means breaking the DNA strands, you know, instead of two strands, instead of like a double helix, you make it like two single helices.
Two single helices. Yeah. And then
you take some clay. And then you basically take some clay and create a mold. You stick it to each end of the strand, and you get essentially like a mold of what it looks like.
It's like fission in cells, right? If you've seen cellular reproduction from under a microscope, they're just like cleaved in half, and then you know that gets. But actually, what's happening at the molecular level in the nucleus is the replication of DNA, and it looks exactly the same here, except that we are doing this in the lab and we can control the way it happens, right? Which is crazy if you think about it. You've mimicked a biological process with temperature. Now, why is temperature important? Because the way it works is there's like three broad steps, right? So you denature the DNA, you really boil the crap out of it, and then you anneal the primers. So remember that it needs a little bit of clay, like you said, so at the very beginning of the strand, so that the photocopier can start doing its work, okay? And so the annealing happens at a certain temperature, the reading happens at another temperature, and then they kind of seal. So now you have two copies, like we said, and then the two becomes four, the four becomes eight, etc., etc. Now, the really cool thing that you can do with PCR and why it's so revolutionary is, like, not only does it, the zeroth level is powerful in just making so much more DNA that you need, is that in that annealing stage, the primer that you put that allows the photocopier to start can have a forced error, okay? That forced error or a mismatch means there's some length of that complementary, that sequence that you put in, the little bit of DNA that you put in, that doesn't match at every single base to the parent strand.
Okay.
There's a parent strand. You introduced one primer. You thought, huh, it'll be exactly ATCC. It'll be the matching sequence, and then they'll continue. Everyone is happy. No, you forced the error. Because you want to make an amino acid sequence of your choice. So you're going to make sure that the DNA sequence matches that amino acid sequence, but based off some parent DNA, right? So through forcing that error, you will now, and if you do the math, and I'm not going to get into it, you're going to get only the predominant species in the population as this explodes exponentially.
Yeah.
The predominant species in the population is going to be the DNA of your choice with that forced error, because you wanted to make that. So now you can take that errored DNA, or rather your manipulated cloned DNA, right, and put that into a cell and make the protein that you wanted to make. So you went from intent to execution because of PCR. You could never do that before. Or you could, but it was very, 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 very hard. Very laborious, very, very trivial, very difficult to do at scale. You can do this in a school lab. It is taught at the school level nowadays, which is ridiculous. Given our backgrounds of where we came from and where we are, it was like, oh, we had to take, you know, get a degree in the field to kind of understand it and test it in the lab. Now it's an everyday thing.
What year was this Nobel Prize given? What year was this PCR discovered?
That is a good question. And I'm going to try a very sort of Joe Rogan approach here and try and pull it up for you. So
yeah, you are
PCR, 1993.
Okay, that's pretty recent then. Oh,
that late, huh?
Yeah, it's, think about it, right? So from 1993 to now, we've got mRNA vaccine technology that is solving a pandemic level problem. That's ridiculous.
So in the PCR incredible test that we do by swabbing our noses for COVID, what happens there?
They are, so we know the sequence of the spike protein, and so we know what its DNA can look like, and so I believe what they're looking for is the presence of that genetic information in the swab, which means that the virus is present. So you are directly probing for the DNA sequence that the virus has. So if you think about it, the virus has its genetic information. You're sending in the known photocopy, saying if the photocopy happens correctly and 25 repetitions later, I have 2 to the 25th number of copies, holy crap, you have the virus. That's basically it. So you're using the photocopy machine to increase your signal-to-noise ratio to tell you if there is actually that genetic information, which is indicative of the virus, of the presence of the virus.
So the forced error here is the virus's sequence of DNA.
Yeah, it'll be viral related sequences.
Yeah. And when you introduce that,
so that goes into the tube.
Yeah. And if the dominant process, the dominant sequence that arises when you do this exponential multiplication of DNA, if that matches the original sequence, you have COVID, because what multiplied
the virals,
was the COVID's virus sequence, DNA sequence.
Exactly.
And not
that's
yours.
Exactly. That is correct. You're not looking for your sequence. I mean, that kind of information is first of all, irrelevant in this context, right? We're checking to see if you have COVID. And secondly, can you imagine if every single testing facility, I mean, the implications of storing an individual's genetic information is there's huge implications. And, you know, there's ethics and regulation and regulatory stuff. So that's obviously much more challenging. So what you're really looking for is there viral genetic information at some level in your nose? If there is, then it is, we're not just saying, oh, you know, there's, you have the virus. It's very, very likely that you do.
Yeah. Got it.
And that you could do because of use. So here, PCR was used as a diagnostic. So you see, the flavor of applications is virtually like limitless. There's biotechnology for making something that you want. You know, you have quantitative PCR where you can make a set amount of DNA. There's diagnostics like this. I mean, it's gotten more and more sophisticated in terms of what those primers are. And, you know, it's expanded the repertoire of molecules and photocopying machines that do that. Photocopying has also increased, which means that there's probably uses of PCR out there that even I'm not familiar with.
Amazing. It's amazing. Awesome. So we should refresh our drinks and
So let's get into it methodically. Now,
yeah.
You know, you are an accomplished scientist in your own right, right? And you're doing important work that you enjoy. But how did it start? I mean, why biotechnology? Why this line of science? And have you thought about, you know, did you get into all of this by accident and by, you know, just circumstances of life and decisions back then? Or was there do you feel like it was an obvious trajectory that led you to this?
No, there was nothing, I think, obvious about it. And while one can argue that, oh, hindsight is 2020, and, you know, you look back and you say, of course, yeah, that this was inevitable. At any given point in time, you know, you're always trying to operate from the perspective of, I'm going to make the best decision I can now with the knowledge I have, hoping for the best in the future. That's it. But there were some, I think, key milestones, right, in this trajectory, so to speak. One of them actually overlaps with you guys, which is kind of insane. I think on a previous episode, you talked about, surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman. That was mind-blowingly formative for me too, which is, I was like jumping with joy when I heard that on one of your previous episodes. I couldn't believe that. You guys, what? I remember calling Vicky and telling you immediately, like, dude, this is insane. Like, and what that did for me. Like, let's drill into that. Like, to me, the free-spirited sort of nature of the man was one thing. But his fearlessness in research, he didn't care about the, you know, the cost or whatever. He was not bound by those rules. Not to say that he was, you know, terrible as a person and did all and blew things up. But within reason, within his social constructs, he operated freely. And he was curious and he was unrelenting, right? That tenacity of questioning, it didn't stem from an insecurity. It didn't stem from, at least to my understanding, right, from a need to be validated. It was genuine curiosity. And I think he gave me some permission to ask those questions. I became one of the most annoying people in my family. Like, there was just, what can you say? Why? This kid will not shut up asking why. And this is a 19-year-old. It's not a 5-year-old kid. But the idea was just that. Okay, you know, you say we do this and there are customs and maybe you do this, but why? Like, I acknowledge it. I'm not questioning the, you know, the power structure or whatever, right? It never came across, or at least from my perspective, when I asked the question why, I think that was when the researcher took root in my being, I think. I think all kids are curious. I mean, you guys both have kids. You know how they operate, right? And I think maybe for a while that curiosity of mine was dormant. And, you know, you're in survival mode as you go through high school. Where are you going to be curious? Just getting through our education system was a task in and of itself. You guys know that.
Oh, yeah. We had a whole episode on that too.
Exactly. Exactly. Pedagogy is insane. It's a big, big topic. So the permission to ask why and never really stop, right? The frame of reference keeps changing when you ask that question. And then thankfully, having the tools to kind of adapt and let your brain kind of wrap itself around those concepts and be satisfied with the answer that you are given then, but probe the next level, probe to the next level. I think that was where the researcher really took root, like I said. So the book was one, and that's just one of those random time points. And it was a crazy story how I got that book too. We had some distant relatives visit us for the first time when we were living as a joint family. And I think they didn't expect me to be there as one of the cousins. They had my other cousin in mind. And so they got two books, okay? And at the time, my cousin was interested in cricket. And the other book was like something about Rahul Dravid or Sunil Gavaskar. I'm not really sure what. And they just happened to have bought, surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman.
Incredible.
Thinking that they would give it to my cousin. But then they saw two kids in the house. And so they gave one to me. And it happened to be that. Otherwise, I don't know, maybe my cousin would have been like the scientist and I would have been like a CPA or something. Which is crazy that happened,
yeah,
right?
It's such a crazy thing. And it's such a great book to get at a certain point in your life. Surely you're joking, Mr. Yeah. Feynman, because it's all these stories about his, you know, adventures about lockpicking and, you know, how he did all this various stuff like physics in strip clubs. And it's so, so crazy. It's amazing.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, in my case, right, I think the reason why this book, this specific book, I could, you know, Vikram is the one who ended up getting it. I don't remember how Vikram got that book, but he told me, look, you got to read this. And that's how, and we were in 12th and we were preparing for those IIT exams, right?
Oh my God.
And I think that was very formative for me simply because in 12th, while I was preparing for IIT, along with Vikram and a couple of other really good friends, I was not good at all. I didn't live up to the mark, right? And if my education in physics, chemistry and math was limited to the instruction we were receiving in class and to those demoralizing exams where I pretty much flunked each and every one of those. So if my exposure to physics was just that, right? Instruction in class plus exams, then I would have totally ditched science and gone into economics or done some MA or something like that, right? And I would have concluded that it's not for me. But because of books like this, which invoke your natural curiosity, even though I was flunking these physics exams, in my mind, I imagined myself to be primed my mind to be curious and start loving, you know, space exploration and all of those other stuff that humanity is attempting. And it wasn't too hard for me to, I didn't get discouraged from these poor marks. And I went on to do some engineering and I like my life right now.
That's very self-effacing. Went on to do some engineering, pursued physics and physics-like fields in spite of not doing that. That speaks to more of your ability and sort of tuning to that research mentality, so to speak, right? But research mentality, research has, as a word, I think, has gotten such an unfortunate negative connotation of people just being very, you know, just droning on and being very, wearing, you know, plaid coats and having elbow patches. I think that's the very unfortunate image that it constructs. But research is exciting because you truly are at the edge of the unknown. I think I saw a very interesting graphical analogy. So when this is like drawn out on a paper, and I think I may have told you this in the past, Vikram, but we'll just talk about this again. So human knowledge as explained on a two-dimensional canvas, okay? So when you're born, you are a dot, you know nothing, your consciousness has just emerged, so to speak, and so you're just learning to speak, walk, eat, sleep, fart, poop, whatever. And then as you grow, that circle expands and becomes, you know, say a centimeter in diameter on a scale of, say, all human knowledge being maybe the size of a parking lot. Let's just say that. And your circle is maybe 1 centimeter. And as you grow, that circle keeps widening. You know, you get a degree. It becomes really quite broad and you have a good understanding. You know, you're in your 20s. You've gotten through probably a very critical phase in life as we know it, right? To be able to get through your 20s is a parenting win. It's a genetic win, right? As far as the biology is concerned, you are primed to now pass on those genes in this social sort of construct to the next generation. regeneration and procreate and etc. Now, when you do something like an engineering or a master's and you start really specializing, that circle starts becoming more egg-shaped. So there is now a directionality and there's a vector to your knowledge on this canvas, okay? And when you get a PhD or an advanced degree, even a master's in that sense, that oblong shape, and now it's actually expanded into an arrow that goes right to the very edge of this parking lot. Okay? Which means you are now literally the world expert in this. Like, there is nobody else who has done what you have done and knows what you know about this very, very, very narrow topic. So that's why it went from being like a shape that had some area to it to being a line to the very edge of human knowledge. And then to do something path-breaking is to take that edge of the parking lot, and they zoom into the kind of line in this next graphic in the window, and it creates a small bump. It extends the boundary by a millimeter. Thereby broadening the entirety of human knowledge.
Yes.
Isn't that a brilliant analogy? It's amazing. Was really something.
So, and that little bump in human knowledge is a plenty of a lifetime achievement for most people even.
Yeah. To be able to do that means, you know, and like, you know, the framework of regret, as I like to call it, is like, oh, if and when the time comes for you to move on, you know, maybe the bucket of regrets you have is tiny. And so that framework of what your regret looks like when it's time for you to die, as however morbid that may sound, needs to be healthy. It needs to be something that, you know, you don't care about your overall career progression, this, that, and all. Have you lived a good life? Have you done something good, maybe? Have you, you know, minimized the number of regrets you have? And if you've done all of this while doing path-breaking work and making money and being well-loved, man, that's you're a hero.
It's like, the dream.
Those are rare.
Yeah, it's the dream, yeah.
That's the dream, yeah, exactly. But then that's also not, I think, truly an unachievable goal for folks like us who've had the backgrounds that we've had. And when I speak to students back home in the same colleges that we went to, I tell them this. I think the first question is born out of insecurity when it comes from the audience. Oh, what about jobs? Sure, that is a valid question, but not to sort of decry that line of reasoning and thinking. You guys are going to have degrees from these universities. You are going to be able to find those jobs. You will work hard and you will survive. So trust yourself, trust a little bit in the process. But that's the baseline. Go beyond that, right? Push for your interest. Push for what you want to do. You, like, if you are insecure about it now, that's healthy and that's good. But it has to kind of, you have to contain it and hold on to it and be inspired. And holding on to that inspiration and seeing it through and eventually achieving your goals, that is the accomplishment. I think the preconceived notion of I will be successful from off the bat. That's it. You know, I'm going to graduate. I'm going to get the best job in the world. I've achieved my life goal. That doesn't happen. I mean, that's unrealistic, right?
That's right, yeah. I think a lot of times you have to define for yourself what success means to you. Like, is pushing the edge of human knowledge 1 millimeter is a major form of success most people can only dream about. You know, you can earn billions of dollars and not do that. But, you know, there are people who, you know, the guy who invented the zipper didn't make a penny. So, you know, I mean, but we all use it everywhere. Yeah. And I do consider that a bump in the 1 mm of human, you know, knowledge, because
absolutely,
you know, it makes life so much better for all of us. But so, you know, to each person has to define what success means. And where inspiration comes from for that, right? I mean, like we all spoke about Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman. Such a good book. We all have common roots to that book, I suppose.
Yep.
But I'm pretty sure that we've all come across people in our lives who have driven us towards these things. Who are some of the people that drove, you know, you towards being inspired in the field of biotechnology to get you where you are today?
Absolutely. That's a great sort of a cornerstone or a pillar, I think, for anyone who does any kind of research. There's either one or more individuals who've done that, for sure. There's no single uninspired researcher, right? Or musician or whoever, I think.
Yeah, it's all a form of...
Yeah, exactly. So for me, there were a few people. I think there was There was a Mr. Vasu who was my 11th and 12th standard teacher. So this is high school here, who taught chemistry, and he taught us physical chemistry. So this was some of the quantum stuff that was really exciting, like electron in a box and stuff like that. And it was just like, I could not get my head around the fuzzy logic of, you know, the wave-particle duality and things like that. It was just insane. And you just have to accept it. And then later on, you fast forward 10 years later when you listen to Feynman in these YouTube videos and he explains, you know, a rubber band and atoms. And he says that it would be unfaithful to explain something in the example, in the context or through an analogy of something else, because that would also reduce to what you are trying to explain now. So he says that he'd be cheating you if he did that. And so he says you at some level or at that level, when you drill down to that subatomic level, you have to just accept the reality for what it is. And that to me, hearing, you know, Mr. Vasu say that in like 2001 and then fast forwarding to like, I don't know, 2020 or 2021, say 20 years later. That is an immovable truth that just is. And that there's some beauty in that, I think. I think there's getting that validation when my brain is obviously changed and is less neuroplastic, I would say, is mind-blowing to me. That is a reality that just persists irrespective of your belief system. Being able to see that you can engage in dialogue and argue the science and just bash your head against the wall saying, I don't understand it. Like, I understand the premises, I understand the building blocks, but the concept doesn't materialize in my head. And Mr. Vasu would smile and he knew what we were going through. Like, that level of scientific empathy, let's call it that, was... Now when I look back, that became a cornerstone.
Yeah.
And let's rewind the clock. A few years before that, in middle to high school, so let's talk about 7th to 10th grade, there was another Mr. Hart who taught us physics and math. What really made it work for me was the clarity with which he taught things. So it was not just shoved down the throat. It was, you were baited enough to walk down that path and let your brain wrap itself around physical concepts. And he did that through structure, right? It was not an unguided situation. It may have seemed very academic and, oh, this has to be run by the syllabus. But he was irreverential enough to the academic syllabus of the school wherein he could get that done. You could do well in the exams. But you also had understanding, which to us, as you guys know, was like mind-blowing if you had something that really you could connect with.
Yeah, and that's a good word, right? I mean, the scientific empathy is a nice way to frame it, because a lot of teachers, they just got to get these kids who are maybe, say, in 8th grade past the finish line. That's the main duty. And the finish line being that exam. Okay, let's just do everything we can to just get these students to the finish line. But in that whole exercise, you've completely forgotten about this curious child who actually wants to know the science. And instead, you're just trying to, you know, sort of teach what's in the textbook or the syllabus. So in your case, you had like a couple of teachers, right? So in middle school and then one in high school, you had those teachers who had the scientific empathy to go beyond just the syllabus and satisfy the curiosity of the students.
But the thing, where it got really, I think, where it assaulted my senses was in graduate school. Because now, what is the idea of graduate school, right? Like thinking, going back to that analogy of pushing the boundary of human knowledge. You've come in with a certain set of skills and knowledge. So you're competent enough, not competent, competent enough to do a certain level of research to push the boundary of what you do and learn something, discover something. But you have to get very comfortable with being uncomfortable. To me, that was very difficult. I think because over time, okay, you've got these scientific accomplishments, you've understood the science, you've gotten through school, you've gotten through life a little bit, you feel like you got this. And, you know, your curiosity is well satiated by I think, the internet as it expanded and bloomed, as we had access that eventually became unlimited, right? Being able to wiki anything, Google anything meant that you felt like maybe you had access to that knowledge or you had that knowledge at your fingertips. Literally, right? But being faced with that ambiguity and uncertainty when a molecule misbehaves or something, and there is no handbook for that. There's no Wikipedia page that tells you what that means. Getting comfortable with that and defining a framework of reference, of knowledge, and then pushing that, really pushing that boundary that we talked about earlier, that was, I think, that was it, right? That was, to me, was my PhD. Like, just figuring that out and instilling that behavioral aspect into what I do and then doing that work took a solid 6 years. It was like my brain just didn't get it. You'd get frustrated. Why is this thing happening? I'm trying this. I've done everything exactly the same. Something failed. Well, there was an unknown parameter that you had no idea. It was an unknown unknown to you at the time. So then you render it as a known unknown, and then you shine light on it, and it becomes known. Mm. And then that is how that boundary gets pushed, because you're accumulating that knowledge of that experience into the model or whatever that you're trying to build. And it's not a model that you're trying to build for the sake of it. You really are trying to wrap around a reality that exists. Again, whether you believe it or not, or whether you know it or not, it's there. Those molecules do what they do, but there's a reason for what they do. And so you have to wrap your brain around it. Yeah. So I think graduate school obviously was the most recent formative experience in that sense. And then, you know, the two teachers in middle school. And then at the very beginning, I think as early as I can remember, it was my grandfather. So I actually dedicated my thesis to him.
Oh, that's awesome.
yeah. So it actually says, I think my mom was not particularly happy about it, because my mom, you know, okay, middle class Indian, we slaved beta padega types of situations, and she was like, oh, this is your grandfather. I thought it would be us. I was like, no, of course it was you. I've acknowledged you in like a letter that is 4 pages long, but let's leave the blank sheet, you know, for the man's name. So about that, so this is really crazy, right? So my grandparents lived in Chennai, and we had moved abroad, and we would visit every summer, and I never could understand why his name was Dr. Parmeshwaran. And I was like, first of all, he doesn't work. Secondly, he's not a doctor. The irony is I have a PhD now. So that's one thing. And so that curiosity, I would ask truly very innocently, but I would be shushed by, you know, either my dad or mom, I don't remember, or it wasn't addressed enough to make me happy, right?
Yes. Just be like, don't be disrespectful.
Or no, not even that. I think they were okay with it. But he would catch me. I was the firstborn on the, you know, whatever, dad's side of thing. And so he was very attached to me, and I was very attached to him. And he would just smile and laugh. It tickled him to no end that I was blown away by the fact. Like, here's like a 6-year-old asking, why are you a doctor but not? And then we would spend essentially the whole day together, you know, running around, playing with the neighbors, kids, whatever. And then in the afternoons, I had a routine, you know, there was lunch, and I was a very, very fussy eater. So after a mega lunch, I would watch The Jungle Book, the animated Disney cartoon. And so, you know, song and dance, maybe that's the artistic influence. I don't know. We'll decide, we'll cut that up later. And then he had a collection of hardbound books that either my dad had, you know, brought and saved over time. And they were on like sci-fi. So sci-fi from the context of 1989, 1990. So this is completely outdated sci-fi by today's standards, okay? But can you imagine what that does to a child's imagination? You open, you see spaceships that don't exist, renderings of planets that don't exist, theories on propulsion that are still vaporware as far as today's technology is concerned. So at that age of like, I don't know, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, I was exposed to the concept of solar propulsion, the Daedalus Project. All this rendered by him, by his words. I can't read that stuff. I don't know what it means. And he would just laugh, and he was like, ah, let's see what these aliens are doing today. And, you know, and we would look through this sci-fi book. Think about that. What a crazy effect. My parents had no clue this was happening, right? They are busy with work, whatever. And one random afternoon, grandfather sits down. This becomes a routine. We're opening these random books. And I was not allowed to touch these books, right? They were on a shelf somewhere. So maybe the engineering mindset came from there. When everyone kind of goes to sleep and the cartoon is finished, I would sneak into his room and quietly try and pull that wooden chair to climb the table to reach the shelf to pull the book. Many scoldings later, the book is in my lap. Achievement unlocked. So I think that was it for me. And I remember this one thing. So as if I know this guy. Richard Feynman talks about opening up a radio, right?
Oh,
yeah. First chapter. I did that to a torch. Okay, it was a, I don't know. You remember in India we used to get those flashlights that were orange plastic with the black switch and a black rim. Yeah. Okay, signature. Like this is just like your run of the mill 80s flashlight. It ran those big Ever Ready batteries. And one day I don't know. I was inspired. Let's call it that. Okay. I take apart the whole thing. I figure out basic electric circuitry on vacation during power cuts when you need the torch, when you need the flashlight. So, and I think probably where I think this, I was validated, I think for the first time that I remember why my parents were having the scientific curiosity was I figured out which screwdriver to use to open up one of the two screws and whatever, and take up the whole thing. And remember, there was a spring that would also hold the batteries in place, and I knew how to take out the spring. Right, those small fingers, very dexterous. So I think, you know, Vicky, you'll relate to, you know, your kids having that ability with that with those fingers. It's really an advantage being that small, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
and I told them, no, trust me. I will put it back together and it will work on the first try. You know, raising the stakes.
Challenge
Let's
accepted.
Go all in.
Yeah.
Right? A challenge accepted. Whatever they let me be, they were probably like, oh, we have other fish to fry. Let's just let this kid do this thing. Lo and behold, it worked. Put the whole thing back. You know, what feels like a trivial thing. Like now, I mean, can you imagine not knowing anything about positive, negative electricity, making sure the polarity is correct, making sure the connection with the bulb is correct, figuring out where on the screw type is the negative and the positive on the bottom. Empirically tested, no idea, right? I have no fundamental concept of electricity as we know it today. So that was, I think, and then being validated by the parents to say, oh, okay, good job, whatever, you know, like, yeah, there's going to be a power cut, so we need it.
Yeah.
Done. That's it.
Yeah. The next time the power went out, you're like, yes, this light is on because of me and my science.
Because of the soon-to-be, you know, Dr. Siddharth Mohan. So like 30 years later.
That's nice.
Yeah.
So is Jungle Book where you got all your grooves from? Your rhythm bones?
Because the rhythm bones, huh?
Why I have to say rhythm bones to people who don't know you already is because you're a damn fine drummer, as is Subbu. So I'm feeling all left out in this conversation because there is a distinct drummer who once told me, like, dude, you play all this guitar, but you really lack a sense of rhythm. I'm like, oh, you are right. You are absolutely right. No offense taken. Agree.
The thing is, when I first met Sidmo, right, in our college Indian band, he wasn't even the drummer. He was hired to play the keyboards.
Yeah, and the bass.
Yeah.
He's a man of many faces.
Oh, no. I was belligerent, I think, with the whole band thing because I had to follow in the wake of the great Black Earth. And for first-time listeners here, you know, Vicky and Subbu are powerhouse musicians who achieved a lot. So it's only unfortunate that you guys are not still a part of a touring band, I would say. And I say that I am a scientist because I am a failed musician. So I'm the other way around, you know. But yeah, I think the idea of grooves, more so the Jungle Book was my dad. So we had, and we still have to this day, the original vinyl records from, you know, like, I think, going back to the 70s of whether it was AC/DC or Pink Floyd or Dire Straits. And for example, like my dad, I don't know whether he is into music, but he never really got into metal. It was he was a little more eclectic in his tastes. And it was just a thing that every weekend in the morning, we would play music. And I knew about Dire Straits, I think from the time when I was born, which is kind of crazy because that really shaped the, you know, my aesthetics, right? And so some very little classical, a lot of rock, a lot of what we call classic rock now. And I remember being fascinated by Thunderstruck or AC/DC. And it's like, oh, you know, this is loud screaming metal. And we would play it and I'd be like, what is that?
That's amazing.
But so that is dad playing music early on. Again, very eclectic. And it kind of died out. I think I pursued music in Russia. So we lived in Russia for a little while. And I was taught the piano by a very strict Russian lady teacher who would whack my knuckles if I played played it
stereotypical
wrong. It was, I am not joking. And then you see a movie like Whiplash and I was like, hey, that's not
that's
too
my
far
life.
From
that's my life.
Exactly.
How old were you?
I think I was close to maybe 8, 9.
Yeah. Not that young.
Eight, nine. So, and it was traumatic because she insisted on keeping like the door closed. So it was just, you know, the sort of overall strong Russian pedagogical, I don't know, influence, whether if that was it or not. And it was traumatizing. I think I began to hate playing the keyboard. It was really something I didn't want to do. I had a year for music in the sense that I could, you know, listen to tunes and replicate it, and I would do that for the longest time. So 10, 15 years go by, I'm in high school, and, you know, yeah, okay, I'll get back to it. The classes here and there, very broken. And then college happens, and then there's this expansion and this explosion of freedom to, you know, do what you want in some sense. And I see this drum kit, and then that's where a lot of the magic for Black Earth also happened,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I remember Subbu was like, and I still call him my drummer brother from another mother, right? But like, I was very much in an exploratory mind space, right?
Yeah.
And I remember sitting behind it, just being fascinated by it before I could even play a 4x4. It took me months to get a 4x4. I just could not believe how awkward the basic, you know, 4/4 timing is, where your dominant hand does 1, 2, 3, 4, your bass drum, your kick goes on 1, your snare goes on 3, and it should feel like a beat instead of just, you're just clunky on it, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, that's the beauty of just putting a bunch of kids who don't know drumming and keep, you know, just putting a drum. We didn't have any teachers, right? And we would just listen to the same kind of music, Metallica. And
yes.
We would just show up the next day to college. And one of us would play, and then we would say, you know, I think this is how it goes. I think I figured it out. Right? So there's no teacher, no one to, and there's no real internet in the way, I mean, there was no YouTube, so no video. So it's pretty much, you had a toy and we just figured it out ourselves. And that was our pastime, essentially.
More so you than me. I think I was lagging in that sense, but I think Subbu was formative in that sense. I think you were, because not only did you teach me a few beats here and there, but first of all, the positive energy, if you know, people ever meet Subbu in real life, they'll know what I'm talking about, right? The positive energy is one thing. The lack of barriers was another. And then you started gifting me stuff. I mean, you had that extra pair of the Lars Ulrich signature sticks, which I was like, what? Okay. And then you had that double pedal kick, double pedal, which I still have, by the way. It's in the cupboard right there.
Yep.
Can you imagine how old is that? It must be at least 25 years old now.
Easily, because I got it. It was a hand-me-down from another accomplished drummer. Her name was Durga. And I really don't know what she's doing right now, but yeah, it was a hand-me-down from a drummer, and then it came to you.
I think you put the Iron Cobra beaters on it, and you sold it to me for a nominal price.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I had to like crowdfund it at that point. But we made all the money back because we started winning competitions. So I landed up paying all the band members
awesome.
Back for that. It was crazy.
Yeah.
So I was just saying that the ultimate validation, I think, in terms of drumming skills, and I think the high point for me, just before you guys left, was you were late for practice or something. And we just had, you guys were, you know, doing Dream Theater's Yitzi Jam at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember distinctly the one part where you decided to chop one part of the bar. Because
okay.
I think the band could not coordinate it. And I remember it was a group call you guys made and decided to cut it. And it irritated me to no end that you guys did that. So I made sure to play through it with you when you were late. But it was like, yeah, there, well, this guy, yeah, replacement drummer.
Replacement
you know,
drummer.
Be like, you're
almost took my job.
You snooze, you lose.
Yeah. Oh my God. That
so
was
wait a minute. I want to go back to, you casually just mentioned Russia. So what's the story there? How did you end up growing up there? Were you born there? I mean, if you were 8, that was probably just a freshly broken up Soviet Union at that point.
Yeah, so this is crazy. So my parents actually studied in Ukraine, and as life would have it, you know, they worked for companies that then eventually had like offices in Russia, and they were in sort of retail and whatnot. So I spent 5.5 years there, 1989 to about 1995, around 6 years. And yeah, we saw the breakup of the USSR. Crazily, we lived on one of the main streets when there was a siege on the White House. And so here, you know, it's like, again, maybe 6, 7 years old. And my father was traveling at the time. So he was working for like an oil corporation. And so he was actually close to the North Pole, like really far away, buried in snow. And then there's the siege happening on the White House. And the tanks roll down our street, okay? So picture this. So it's like the middle of the night, an earthquake like sort of experience, right? Because the tracks really are very, very loud, and there's a lot of vibrations of the tanks on the road. And it's dark, it's dimly lit. And so my mom is obviously panicking, and you know, we were like, what is going on? So, you know, look outside the window and I see the tanks. And being the age I am, I'm like, yeah. Oh my God, this is so cool.
That's like the best thing that could ever happen to you.
Can you imagine? You see tanks rolling around. You're like, wow. No concept of war, politics, nothing. And my mom, on the other hand, of course, was panicked. So we had to take shelter in the far side of the house, kind of hoping and praying that nothing would happen, desperately calling people, wondering what's going to happen. And that's it. And I just remember being just fascinated as a kid by that. Just, can you, so that dissonance and that kind of oil and water is sort of a mix of a child's, I don't know, innocence, if you want to call it that, overlaid in a deeply, deeply dark part of human history, you know, the fallout of the USSR and where things are today. It's just like, I can't believe that I was a part of those experiences. It blows my mind.
It's pretty crazy.
Going back to your music, you know, endeavors in life, you have a pretty awesome project with your wife called What's the Scene? That's all about. Fill us in.
So, as you know, and as I've said a few times, I am a scientist because I am a failed musician. So, I moved to Mysore for my first job as an IT engineer. I land up in Mysore. I frequent Bangalore a lot. I meet a bunch of other people. I didn't start another band, but I was playing with another band with another friend. And we were doing gigs locally in Mysore and Bangalore and whatnot. And eventually, I landed up in Bangalore because I had malaria. A mosquito bit me and I nearly died 2 times.
Oh, my God.
And because of that, I met my wife. So, in our context, Cupid was a mosquito.
Mm.
Okay. Literally. Like, it's the only reason we met. Because I had malaria. And in Bangalore, she was, I think, fascinated by how fascinated I was with music and really was into the scene and was trying to do all this, and she couldn't believe that it was this hard. And we, you know, there are all these challenges: access to equipment, access to gigs, there's no promotional framework, nothing, there's just no real representation. And she is an accomplished, well, now she's a writer, director, actor, playwright, and super, super sort of artistic, has a super artistic output. But at that time, she was a very, very avid writer. She used to blog like crazy, and she won an All India Award and whatnot for like just being an incredible writer. Mm. So that's a whole new podcast you'll have to do with her. But eloquence, yeah, her eloquence, I think, really spilled over into the scene. And so by that, I mean, she wanted to get to the bottom of this and figure out what it was that really makes the scene tick. So we started off this sort of initiative as a newsletter within the company, right? We had a weekly release. We said, we're going to get a bunch of enthusiastic people to talk about the scene. What does that mean? It means we have a gear enthusiast to talk about gear, you know, what's the cutting edge, maybe make it advertisable and, you know, try and sink our teeth into some collaborations with import-export folks, you know, the music stores and whatnot. Or we can also talk about the latest albums that our favorite bands are releasing. And we could talk about bands locally and kind of put them on the same page. I mean that very literally. And say, and so do these reviews. And we wanted them to be objective. We wanted them to be academic. And really, you know, someone has to, we wanted to show that we were putting a lot of thought into the output of your average Indian musician, and do the same for like an Opeth or a Dream Theater. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind, that was our approach to kind of level the playing field, okay? From a listener's and a consumer's standpoint.
Yeah.
So that was the newsletter. Now it suddenly, it snowballed. It really grew into something. Like, if we were late by a few hours, not even a day, right? If we did not release it at 3 p.m. on a Friday, people would email us. Where is this? What's going on, guys? We were really excited about this. I was like, wow, there is interest in this. We did not think that this would happen. So what started off as, I think, as a journalistic interest project for Priyanka primarily and for me as, yeah, you know, I have the scene experience, I'll be the cool consultant or whatever. We sort of started this together and it really, really picked up. I mean, by we saw that it would be limited by being restricted to a bulletin board in the company, and we decided to go outside. We were like, we're going to go to Facebook. The internet is exploding. There's all these social media platforms. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. And we did. And then we started, you know, in Bangalore. We're like, okay, let's go attend a gig. Let's write about that gig. Let's photograph it. Let's put it up on the website, put it up on the social media and see if people are interested in this. It was, yeah, of course. Oh my God. So we had a logo built. There was a brand built around it. We started the company, you know, just like a small company at the time, right? Whatever, it's like a limited liability partnership mm-hmm. or a sole proprietorship or whatever. And we started documenting the scene. Now, word got around. We started getting all access passes to all these venues. And at that time, it was burgeoning. It was really something that was, you know, we had all these like Kairas and B-flats. And it was like amazing to see the scene in Bangalore. Why restrict to Bangalore? We are operating on a digital platform. We can start, you know, if we communicate the value system and the model and have a hub and spoke sort of approach across different cities, we can have different teams. So at one point, we were operating out of 10 cities in the country.
That's nice.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's real nice yeah. scaling.
So we became known as the mirror of the scene, if you want to call it that. And, you know, people like Veer Das endorsed us 10 years ago.
Who is Veer Das?
Which to me is crazy. He probably doesn't remember us today. Veer Das is a fantastic Indian comedian who is based out of India and has an Indian flavor to his comedy, so to speak, but has made it internationally. And I think he was into this kind of music. I hope he still is. Mm. And he had endorsed us way back then saying, yeah, What's the Scene is doing legit work. We have photographers and reviewers in all these cities. We have editors who coordinate all of this and, you know, make sure that the content is delivered on time and delivered to the right place. And, you know, we have fact checking and error checking, and it was polished content that was out there. Yeah.
It's amazing. So is What's the Scene still active?
It is. So as life would have it, you know, my wife and I, we were still just only dating and friends and then dating at the time. And so it was a tumultuous ride through life. And, you know, I moved abroad and it was difficult to kind of do things remotely. And then even she moved here. And so we kind of went through a bit of a hiatus. And I think it was for good measure because the scene changed on us. I mean, literally changed for the worse, I would think. You know, there's all these restrictions that exist right now. The way music is consumed in India has also changed. Mm. All those venues that had sort of supported the independent music scene, I think, evolved or devolved or closed down. And so we went through, I would say, a bit of an identity, I wouldn't say crisis, but a change. And we kind of revamped the model in the last 3-4 years. And we went, again, virtual, but we have a much more focused approach where we have aggregated data, aggregated reviews. You know, the social media platform focus has changed, but we're still essentially trying to do the same thing. We're trying to now, and not just sort of restricted to reviews and documenting the scene, we want to connect and allow musicians to kind of leverage our platform to promote and collaborate and do stuff like do things in a way that is representative of a well-oiled framework or structure. The scene has no shape, so to speak. If you ask an average Indian band or band member, what does it take to succeed? You're going to get a variety of answers. Now, while diversity of thought and execution is great, there isn't really any one clear path. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that by doing what we do, that we can help define that and crystallize that and really tap into the scene. I mean, we are a country of over 1 billion. There are brilliant musicians our country. And so there's all this talent that just does not get access.
Yep. No discovery.
And so while we're trying... Yeah, so we want to be a discovery engine without being an online radio. So you see, like, there's semantics and sort of nuances there that I think we're continuously figuring out and learning. But What's the Scene is just that. It is We want to be the scene. This is the scene. It's our scene. We are the scene.
Yeah.
In fact, all the members, you know, it almost became like I won't say a cult, but it was a great sense of solidarity when we were the broad older model. It was, we are the scene, WTS. Yeah. We are the scene. What's the scene? So there was a great sense of enthusiasm. People did it out of passion. We didn't make any money off this. In fact, it sucks money. Like,
yeah.
You know, we spent a lot of money on making sure the website was built from scratch. We paid designers. We just went through a revamp process. But the really nice thing is that the support that we've gotten from consumers, other pillars in the industry, and the bands and the musicians themselves, you can't plan for this stuff. I mean,
it's amazing.
Unbelievable.
Right? Yeah. It's the force of what you do when you start a project. We'll do this. I know that the Instagram handle is WTS India for What's the Scene India. And any additional links, it'll be in the show notes. So you should definitely check out all the What's the Scene stuff. There's some really good music and stuff on the Indian music scene that is awesome. It's good for the bands. It's good for diversity. So we'll definitely have links to that stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, Sidmo, so thanks for joining us on this journey. I mean, educating us about the science that you work on, talking to us about your personal life. And it was, it's obviously always fun digging into our past and making a record of it. I think that's one of the main reasons why we even started this podcast. In a way, it was for a selfish reason of making a record of all the fun that we've had in our past, right? And I think that's exactly what we did today. So thanks for that. And I hope listeners are also going to enjoy this episode. We'll have links to all of the stuff that we spoke about in the part one of the science section, and also all the Indian music that we spoke about. And that's it for this episode. Thank you.
Thank you.